Welcome to Leaders and Legends of Online Learning, a podcast dedicated to the experts. Thank you for listening. Each episode, we'll be learning from the world's leading thinkers and practitioners in online learning and linking to ideas relevant to online teaching, working with online learners, and digital education. You can listen to the experts and check their profiles and link to some of their work on our website, www.onlinelearninglegends.com. I'm Mark Nichols, the interviewer in this episode. You'll meet Emeritus Professor Terry Anderson in this episode. Terry is well known internationally for his work in online education, particularly for his involvement with the Community of Inquiry framework and for the Interactional Equivalence Theorem. Terry and I talked via Skype with Terry in Edmonton. Well, I'm joined by Emeritus Professor Terry Anderson of Athabasca University. Terry is Editor Emeritus of the open access journal The International Review of Research on Open and Distance Learning, a RODL, and a member of the TECRI, the Technology Enhanced Knowledge Research Institute at Athabasca University. He's also very well known for his keynotes around the world. Terry, you're a legend of online learning, and it's great to be talking with you.
Oh, well, thank you, Mark. I'm quite honored to get a chance both to talk to you and to be able to share a few ideas or thoughts with other distance education practitioners and researchers around the world.
Terry, to kick us off, can you give us a brief overview of your career and also your publications?
Well, I grew up in a Canadian city, and when I was 20 years old, I sort of followed the siren song of the Back to the Land movement, and I moved up to a rural farm about 220 miles north of Edmonton in the Peace River country of Alberta. And, oh, I learned to farm, do woodworking, this and that. But the last 4 years that I was there, I worked at a local community college teaching computer science courses. And it was at that time that I got exposed to distance education, in that the Northern Lakes College, they ran, I think, 10 or 12 of these one-room adult learning centers where there would be one teacher and there would be a box of Alberta Correspondence School, and they would be finishing their high school by churning through print packages from correspondence model. And we soon realized that that model was not very effective. Students weren't completing, and it was dead boring to do more than one or two of them. So we started doing audio teleconferencing, and I sort of got my first exposure to distance education that was enhanced by some real-time interaction. And it wasn't just interaction with a teacher. They would get three students from Loon Lake and two from Red River and various other places and make a course. And I got quite interested in both the technology and the pedagogy of how you develop courses and when you use that interaction. There was a new network that was being formed in Northern Ontario, which came to be called Contact North. I was fortunate enough to be selected, along with Judy Roberts, to be the first directors of that network. And so we moved to Ontario, and I spent 5 years developing. Eventually, we had almost 50 of these learning centers. And we, too, carried on the audio teleconferencing tradition, but we also added a computer networking. It was pre-internet days, but we were using some early Canadian networks, mostly for administration, but also trying to experiment with bulletin boards, that sort of systems. And maybe it was fortunate or unfortunate that my office was located right in the education faculty at Lakehead University for Contact North. And I saw the lifestyle of those professors, and I thought, that is for me. But I didn't have the ticket. I didn't have the PhD. So my family and I, we moved back to Calgary, where I entered the PhD program in education psychology. And I was fortunate enough to work with Randy Garrison, who became my supervisor. And we ended up working together quite a bit after that. So I did my PhD, and it was on audio conferencing, actually. There wasn't enough digital conferencing going on at that time. And I was then and am now very pragmatic when it comes to research, especially for graduate students, is to just do something that's possible, something that you can actually measure and you can actually work with, and they're close at hand or whatever. But I was still interested in digital communication, and I had no longer was able to go to the ICDE conferences and the CAID conference, the Canadian Association Distance Ed, because I didn't have much money. And so I thought, well, what if we did a digital conference that sat on top of the ICDE conference in Bangkok, World Conference. And I tried to figure out how you could do this. And we didn't have the internet at those times. There was Usenet and Bitnet and NetNorth and a bunch of other hodgepodge networks that we had what we called porters. And they were people who would take an email message or a series of email messages from one system and cut and paste it into another one or copy it and move things along that way. So we did the first virtual conference, got six speakers to be keynotes, and it was quite a success. I met a whole bunch of new people, new contacts through that while sitting in Calgary doing my own research. And so I think that's my one and only claim to fame in the international or the internet community is that I think I ran the first virtual conference online, of which, of course, there are still conferences going on today. And then shortly after I graduated, I was fortunate enough to get a job at the University of Alberta, which is quite a large research university. And they were worried that they were falling behind in the digital race, and they wanted an evangelist to come. And I was called at first the alternative delivery specialist, and that was a little unnerving for the obstetricians and the medical faculty. But that changed, and I ended up growing a little group of technical and instructional design people, and we worked with some success, sort of introducing lots of professional development, the kind of units that are certainly more common today. But I never really did much distance education because it was it just didn't seem to be a priority for that institution, as it is not today. But I was fortunate in that I talked Randy Garrison into coming and being the dean of the faculty there. And so I continued to work with him. And it was at that time that we developed the community of inquiry model. And as you know, that's become very popular. And I think its greatest strength is its simplicity. The Venn diagram of presences gives an insight to a practitioner as well as a researcher on, well, here's what I should be working at. If your course isn't working, here are some simple things that I could do that will allow me to, you know, enhance one of those three kinds of presences. But again, I really did miss the distance ed world and the context that I had within it. And so when I was offered a Canada Research Chair in distance education at Athabasca University, I accepted that. And then I was 15 years at Athabasca in the Center for Distance Education, where I taught master's and later doctoral students, did a lot of research methods courses, and also got involved with and enhancing eRotal at that time.
So, Terry, obviously you've written a lot over the years, and your name is very, very well known, of course, in online education circles. What are some of the ideas and themes that your work has provided that you sense are still really pertinent today?
Well, maybe I could just tell a story of one of the ones that's been most interesting to me and maybe a bit perplexing, and that is, I don't know if you have heard of Anderson's famous interaction equivalency theory.
Yes, I have. I was going to ask you about that.
That arose because as more technology came along and the possibilities for enhanced kinds of communications, all the way from immersive environments to video to text-based, all of the social interactions came along, and then also the increases in the quantity and the availability of video and other content that was being distributed in early days as open source and as proprietary product. I began to realize that, boy, if we weren't careful, distance education wouldn't be affordable anymore. We'd have so many goodies packed onto it that, you know, like Santa can't even lift his bag anymore because it's so full of presents. And the kind of expectation or that students might have or that faculty might have, and that university presidents did not want to have with big price tags associated with distance education. Hmm. So I was perplexed by this because I thought, well, it's true that if we add audio and video and text interaction, that completion rates improve, for example. Yeah. And so there's many sort of small things we could do. But at what point did it all sort of start adding up to being just too much trouble and too expensive for students and for teachers? And so I thought about this for most of a summer. And then I remember walking down a country road in Ontario where my in-laws have a cabin, and thinking about it, thinking, well, what if there's some easy, magical, mathematical formula that could provide direction for this. And so then I thought, well, maybe, just maybe, if you had really high quality peer-to-peer interaction or quality student-teacher interaction, very low numbers, that sort of thing, or if you had really great content, as in maybe you could say that about some of the MOOCs that we have, that you don't need the other two. That just one will give you a meaningful and maybe an adequate educational experience. And so I thought about that and wrote it up in fancy academic language and got it published. So I more or less thought that's a good idea. Maybe it'll just be a thought piece for somebody else along the way. But then gradually over the years, people have used it. Most, I guess, a meta-analysis came out of Concordia University where they tried to look at multiple studies where they increased one of those three types of interaction and saw which one had the greatest increase, if any, and was it really necessary to have all three of them. And then a Japanese colleague set up a website for it, and we've been sort of gathering over the years various pieces of studies as they've come in, and it's a bit gratifying. I think it was very simplistic. Again, like the community of inquiry model, the value is, in my mind, of research models is that they can be used by practitioners. And if you get a model that has, you know, 14 arrows and so much percentages of this and that, and it gets so complicated that hardly anybody can understand it. That wasn't the kind of output that I was looking for. But the idea that make sure that you get a really good teacher content interaction or a really good teacher, and then put as much of the other two in as you can afford to do, or you want to do, or your students are demanding to do, but don't worry that you have to be perfect just to have a learning experience.
There's an elegant simplicity about that, which is really appealing, and it's probably part of the model's success.
I think so. And I would be naive to say that, you know, that you can get by, you know, 100% your whole university degree with just watching videos, for instance, high content. Mm. But nonetheless, you can certainly pass a course or two that way with no trouble. And then I guess the other thing that interested me was methodologically, partly because I was teaching a lot of methods courses, was being dissatisfied with the kind of, a lot of the qualitative research that was coming out of distance ed was kind of, I knew the answers before even the questions were asked, that, you know, like, how does a student get involved in their profession through distance education, or what are the distractions to going online, or those kind of qualitative questions. The quantitative questions also didn't do too much for me because they were often asking questions, you know, nice to know kind of stuff, you know, do females outperform males, or what kind of socioeconomic group do you have? And so lots of big surveys and that kind of thing. I thought that wasn't really getting at the questions that the practitioners or that I needed in my practice. Mm. And so then I started following action research and getting more interested in it. And then I was exposed to design-based research, mostly coming out of the States, although I know there's a European tradition of it as well. But what I really found attractive about it was that it said, do an intervention, make something change in your course, and then measure it in multiple methods, whatever ways that you can. The difference between design-based and classic action research is that not only designing an intervention, but measuring it effectively is not a skill or a project that a lot of teachers have time for. And so I really push for partnerships between a researcher and a practitioner. And I think that could be really important for the kind of units that I meet, maybe like yours at the OpenU, but where we're charged with trying to enhance the professional development of other faculty members. Well, that kind of partnership where if you ask a history prof to do an educational study, they often say, well, I don't know anything about the literature. I don't know anything about the theoretical models, blah, blah, blah. But as educational technologists and educational psychologists, we do have that background. But what we don't have is the subject matter knowledge, and we certainly don't have the access and the support of local practitioners. And so the two together, I think, it makes a really powerful contribution or collaboration. And from that, they can do an intervention. And typically in design-based research, it cycles. It goes round and round. You don't get it right the first time, and it improves the second time. And hopefully you can, you know, broaden the scale of it by, you know, showing other people how effective they are or what the challenges are or what the promise of this intervention is. I started writing more about research methodology, I guess, as much as the actual doing it myself, maybe easier.
Well, I'm hoping we can link to some of your work on that, because I know from my own history, the design-based research has certainly been amongst the most helpful of research insights to take forward.
Right.
So, Terry, it's now towards the end of 2018. What are your observations about online learning and education at the present time? What sort of themes leap out at you?
Well, I guess I am encouraged about the diversity. I see many startup companies still trying to invent the perfect educational tool, and I think many of them have lots of promise. I am a bit more depressed about the lack of institutional will, not just at the post-secondary, but at the K-12 world too, of faculty members or teachers and administrators to really believe in their hearts that they can do a better job and that it isn't going to be that much harder for them. I think people get into a kind of a mode of delivery and get the machine running again and then turn it on and run it again next year kind of thing. That I think if you're a university researcher, you know you can't do that in your research side of your job, but there is an expectation almost that you'll do it on the teaching side. And so the scholarship of teaching and learning, I was very encouraged about that about 15 or 20 years ago. It survives, but it's certainly marginal to the research-based funding models and promotion models that we see today. So the research, the opportunity, and just very briefly, the last project I did last year was for the Alberta Teachers Association, and we interviewed a bunch of teachers about their network use. And we used a technology much like or Skype or Google Hangouts or something like that. And then we took that MP3 broadcast and we just uploaded it to a program called Trint, T-R-I-N-T. Yeah. And bang, it came back in 5 minutes, translated into text. And it wasn't perfect, but the beauty of it was it gave you an editor where you could listen to the audio conversation at the same time as it showed you what it thought it heard or the text that it had produced. Mm. And it allowed to edit it. And so those kind of research techniques, I don't know, Mark, how much you've done personally, but doing transcripts is a lot of work and a lot of time. And so, when you see these research methodologies and some of the new statistics programs that do qualitative or analysis of qualitative data as well as quantitative, it's quite amazing the opportunities we have to do more effective research. So I see those things being very hopeful signs for educational research. Mm-hmm. I see more and more distance education journals. I see that many of the developing countries are now starting their own journals, which I think is good. Yeah. I think there's real debate about, especially the English language hegemony on academic discourse that really disadvantages third world scholars. And so I'm looking forward to the day when we'll have both machine translation that is good enough and when research is really distributed internationally at no or low cost.
Yeah. Trint sounds very interesting. I thought Zotero was big and then Mendeley, but it sounds like I've got a few other tools to check out.
Exactly. Well, there's always a new one around the corner too, which is healthy.
Terry, imagine you had an unlimited budget and could follow your curiosity. What research would you most like to see about online education?
I guess I'd like to see more research done on models of learning that allow individuals to sort of set their own course, their own curriculum, their own learning group, allow them to meet up appropriately, and that, of course, are all credentialed by well-known universities to make it sort of worthwhile. Yeah. So the lifelong learning, the self-organization, the hootagogical kinds of models, I think that we're entering an area where both there's demand for it and the tools are certainly there to really make self-driven learning more possible. And we come out of a distance ed tradition where it was thought that there was only a very few sources of knowledge, a few textbooks, And we didn't really develop for a world of abundance, as George Siemens always says. But now we're certainly into that, and it's growing maybe exponentially. But, you know, the number of resources are staggering, and it's just a question of doing the research to how to put these things together to make learning packages which don't take the student initiative and keep the student in the driver's seat of their own learning. How we actually do that, the kind of learning activities, and the kind of support that student needs, because they haven't had a lot of experience in self-directed learning after they finish even an undergraduate degree. You know, what's the objectives, when's the test is kind of their thing about learning, but really it's what do I want to learn and how am I going to learn how to do it. So I think that to me is maybe the most exciting, and maybe it's technologically driven a bit, but nonetheless, so is my life, I guess.
Well, I'm picking up through this conversation that there's an innovative drive to you, which is often sparked by not seeing things the way they ought to be. I get a sense that you see some fantastic potential here, and there's a frustration that we're not yet doing it.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, I always have lots of wonderful ideas for work for other people to do.
Well, Terry, two people you'd recommend as legends of online learning, one whose work or perspective is significantly influencing you, and one who you think otherwise has an important perspective to share.
I think a gentleman you've interviewed, a fellow Canadian, Tony Bates, has always been one of my heroes and mentors. Yeah. He has been able to sort of marry the administrative, the bucks, the dollars, the kind of the nuts and bolts of distance education, with an idea of how you can actually get faculty and student engaged with the learning kind of imperative. And he's been able to talk to university presidents and others, and his own writing and research, I think, has been great. And so he's certainly been one of my heroes. The other, you know, I've collaborated with a number of very intelligent and motivated people, but the person who's the most far-thinking in my experience, and I've enjoyed working with the most, is John Dron. He isn't as well-known. He isn't even in an education faculty. He's in an information science, computer science kind of background. But he has a really deep understanding of theoretical insights into education, I think. And he's also got the capacity to program and to build these tools himself or his students. So he's been a good friend as well, but he certainly is a good writer and a really brilliant guy. And then I know I'm just talking about all my old buddies, I guess, here. But Rory McGreal, with his UNESCO chair in open education resources, I think he's been a force for the OER world, as Martin Weller has as well.
Well, Terry, thank you very much for your time. You certainly are a legend of online learning. I've certainly enjoyed your work over the years. In fact, I was looking at the Community of Inquiry model last night, just for another paper that I've been preparing. It's been a real privilege talking with you. Thank you very much for joining me.
You're quite welcome. And it's been a pleasure. And thank you for doing this initiative. I think it is really important for us old guys to get it out there, but also I hope that it'll be of some interest and inspiration to others.
Absolutely. Thank you.
You can find Terry's profile and links to his research from our website. His Twitter handle is Turguy. That concludes this episode. Be sure to go to our website, www.onlinelearninglegends.com, to follow up on this episode's guest. You'll also find links to others whose ideas continue to inspire and teach online learning professionals, and you can subscribe to future interviews. If you know of a leader or legend we've not yet talked to, please do drop us a line at onlinelearninglegends@gmail.com.